Chapter 24. The Flower of Dissolution. Beside me, Dorcas plucked a water hyacinth and put it in her hair. Except for the vague spot of white on the bank some distance ahead, it was the first flower I had seen in the Garden of Endless Sleep. I looked for others but saw none. Is it possible the flower came into being only because Dorcas reached for it? In daylight moments, I know as well as the next that such things are impossible, but I am riding by night. And then, when I sat in that boat with the hyacinth less than a cubit from my eyes, I wondered at the dim light and recalled Hildegrin's remark of a moment before. A remark that implied, though quite possibly he did not know it, that the Cirrus's cave, and thus this garden, was on the opposite side of the world. There, as Master Malrubius had taught us long ago, all was reversed. Warmth to the south, cold to the north, light at night, dark by day, snow in summer. The chill I felt would be appropriate then, for it would be summer soon, with sleet riding the wind. The darkness that stood even between my eyes and the blue flowers of the water hyacinth would be appropriate then too, for it would soon be night, with light already in the sky. The Increate maintains all things in order, surely, and the Theologicans say light is his shadow. Must it not be, then, that in darkness order grows ever less, flowers leaping from nothingness into a girl's fingers, just as by light in spring they leap from mere filthiness into the air? Perhaps when night closes our eyes, there is less order than we believe. Perhaps, indeed, it is this lack of order we perceive as darkness. A randomization of the waves of energy, like a sea, the fields of energy, like a farm, that appear to our deluded eyes, set by light in an order of which they themselves are incapable, to be the real world. Mist was rising from the water, reminding me first of the swirling motes of straw in the insubstantial cathedral of the Pelerines. Then of steam from the soup kettle when Brother Cook carried it into the refectory on a winter afternoon. The witches were said to stir such kettles, but I had never seen one, though their tower stood hardly a chain from ours. I remembered that we rode across the crater of a volcano. Might it not have been the Cumaean's kettle? Earth's fires were long dead, as Master Malrubius had taught us. It was more than possible that they had cooled long before men had risen from the position of the beasts to cumber her face with their cities. But witches, it was said, raised the dead. Might not the Cumaean raise the dead fires to boil her pot? I dipped my fingers into the water. It was as cold as snow. Hildegrin leaned toward me as he rode, then drew away as he pulled his oars.
"Go unto your death," he said. "That's what you're thinking. I can see it in your face. To the sanguinary field, and he'll kill you, whoever he is."
"Are you?" Dorcas asked and gripped my hand. When I did not answer, Hildegrin nodded for me.
"Don't have to, you know. There's them that doesn't follow the rules and yet runs free."
"You're mistaken," I said. "I wasn't thinking about monomachy or dying either." In my ear, too softly, I think, even for Hildegrin to hear, Dorcas said, "Yes, you were. Your face was full of beauty, of a kind of nobility. When the world is horrible, then thoughts are high, full of grace and greatness." I looked at her thinking she was mocking me, but she was not. "The world is filled half with evil and half with good. We can tilt it forward so that more good runs into our minds, or back, so that more runs into this? A movement of her eyes took in all the lake. But the quantities are the same. We change only their proportion, here or there. I would tilt it as far back as I can, until at last the evil runs out altogether. I said, "It might be the good that would run out, but I am like you. I would bend time backward if I could." Nor do I believe that beautiful thoughts or wise ones are engendered by external troubles. I did not say beautiful thoughts, but thoughts of grace and greatness. Though I suppose that is a kind of beauty. Let me show you. She lifted my hand and, slipping it inside her rags, pressed it to her right breast. I could feel the nipple, as firm as a cherry, and the warmth of the gentle mound beneath it, delicate, feather-soft and alive with racing blood. "Now," she said, "what are your thoughts? If I have made the external world sweet to you, aren't they less than they were?" "Where did you learn all this?" I asked. Her face was drained of its wisdom, which condensed in crystal drops at the corners of her eyes. The shore on which the Averns grew was less marshy than the other. It seemed strange, after having walked on buoyant sedge and floated on water for so long, to set foot again on soil that was no worse than soft. We had landed at some distance from the plants, but we were near enough now that they were no longer a mere bank of white, but growths of definite color and shape, whose size could be readily estimated. I said, "They are not from here, are they? Not from our earth." No one replied. I think I must have spoken too softly for any of the others, except perhaps Dorcas, to hear. They had a stiffness, a geometrical precision, surely born under some other sun. The color of their leaves was that of a scarab's back, but infused with tints at once deeper and more translucent. It seemed to imply the existence of light somewhere, some inconceivable distance away, of a spectrum that would have withered or perhaps ennobled the world. As we walked nearer, Agia leading the way, I following her with Dorcas behind me and Hildegrin following us, I saw that each leaf was like a dagger blade, stiff and pointed, with edges sharp enough to satisfy even Master Gerlo's. Above these leaves, the half-closed white blossoms we had seen from across the lake seemed creations of pure beauty, virginal fantasies guarded by 100 knives. They were wide and lush, and their petals curled in a way that should have seemed tousled if it had not formed a complex swirling pattern that drew the eye like a spiral limned on a revolving disc. Agia said, "Good form requires that you pick the plant yourself, Severian. But I'll go with you and show you how. The trick is to put your arm under the lowest leaves and snap the stem off the ground." Hildegrin caught her by the shoulder.
"That you won't, mistress," he said, and then to me. "You go forward, since you're of a mind to, young seer. I'll take the females to safety."
I was already several strides past him, but I stopped for an instant when he spoke. Luckily, Dorcas called out, "Be careful," at that moment, and I was able to pretend it was her warning that had halted me. The truth was otherwise. From the time we had met Hildegrin, I had felt certain I had encountered him before, though the shock of recognition that had come so swiftly when I saw Sior Racho again was in this instance long delayed. Now it had come at last. with paralyzing force. As I have said, I remember everything, but often I can find a fact, face, or feeling only after a long search. I suppose that in this case, the problem was that from the moment he had bent over me on the sedge track, I could see him clearly, and previously, I had hardly seen him at all. It was only when he said, "I'll take these females to safety," that my memory closed upon his voice. "The leaves are poisoned," Adjie called. "Twisting your mantle tight about your arm will give you some protection, but try not to touch them. And watch out. You are always closer to an Avern than you think."
I nodded to show I understood. Whether the Avern is deadly to the life of its own world, I have no way of knowing. It may be that it is not, that it is only dangerous to us by reason of a nature accidentally inimical to our own. Whether that is so or not, the ground between and beneath the plants was covered with short and very fine grass, grass quite different from the coarse growth elsewhere, and this short grass was littered with the curled bodies of bees and dotted with the white bones of birds. When I was no more than a couple of paces from the plants, I stopped, suddenly aware of a problem I had given no thought to previously. The Avern I selected would be my weapon in the contest to come. Yet because I knew nothing as yet of the way it would be fought, I had no means of judging which plant might be best adapted to it. I could have gone back and questioned Adjie, but I would have felt absurd examining a woman on such a matter, and in the end I decided to trust my judgment, since she would no doubt send me back for another if my first choice were wholly unsuitable. The Averns varied in height from seedlings of hardly more than a span to old plants of 3 cubits or a little less. These older plants had fewer, though larger, leaves. Those of the smaller ones were narrower, and so closely spaced that the stems were completely hidden. Those of the big plants were much broader in proportion to their length, and somewhat separated on the fleshy-looking stems. If, as seemed likely, the Septentrion and I were to use our plants as maces, the largest possible plant with the longest possible stem and the stoutest possible leaves would be the best. But these all grew well away from the edges of the planting, so that it would be necessary to break down a number of smaller plants to reach them, and to do that by the method Adjie had advised was clearly impossible, because the leaves of many of the smaller plants grew nearly to the ground. In the end, I chose one about 2 cubits high. I had knelt beside it and was reaching toward it, when, as though a veil had been snatched away, I realized that my hand, which I had thought still several spans from the needle-like point of the nearest leaf, was about to be impaled. I drew it back hurriedly. The plant seemed almost out of reach. Indeed, I was not certain I could touch its stem even by lying prone. The temptation to use my sword was very great, but I felt it would disgrace me before Adjie and Dorcas to do so, and I knew I would have to handle the plant during the combat in any case. I advanced my hand again, cautiously, this time keeping my forearm in contact with the ground, and discovered that though I had to press my shoulder against the grass, as well to prevent my upper arm from being stabbed by the lowest leaves, I could touch the stem quite readily, a point that appeared to be half a cubit from my face, trembled with my breath. It was while I was snapping off the stem, no easy task, that I saw the reason only the short, soft grass flourished beneath the Averns. One of the leaves of the plant I was breaking had cut half through a blade of coarse marsh grass, and the entire grass plant,
almost an ell across, had begun to wither. Once picked, the plant was an enormous nuisance, as I ought to have anticipated. It would plainly have been impossible to carry it in Hildegrin's boat as it was, without killing one or more of us. So before we re-embarked, I had to climb the slope and cut a sapling. When the twigs had been lopped, Agia and I bound the avern to one end of its spindly trunk, so that, as we made our way through the city later, I appeared to be bearing some grotesque standard. Then Agia explained the use of the plant as a weapon. And I broke a second plant, although she objected, and at even greater risk, I fear, than before, since I was somewhat too confident, and practiced what she had told me. The avern is not, as I had assumed, merely a viper-toothed mace. Its leaves can be detached by twisting them between the thumb and forefinger in such a way that the hand does not contact the edges or the point. The leaf is then, in effect, a handleless blade, envenomed and razor-sharp, ready to throw. The fighter holds the plant in his left hand by the base of the stem and plucks the lower leaves to throw with his right. Agia cautioned me, however, to keep my own plant out of my opponent's reach, since as the leaves are removed, an area of bare stem appears, and this he might grasp and use to wrest my plant from me. When I flourished the second plant and practiced striking out with it, and picking and throwing the leaves, I found that my own avern was likely to be almost as great a danger to me as the Septentrion's. If I held it near me, there was a grave risk of pricking my arm or chest with the long lower leaves. And the flower, with its swirling pattern, held my gaze whenever I glanced down to tear off a leaf, and with the dry lust of death sought to draw me to it. All this seemed unpleasant enough, but when I had learned to keep my eyes away from the half-closed blossom, I reflected that my opponent would be exposed to the same dangers. Throwing the leaves was easier than I had supposed. Their surfaces were glossy, like the leaves of many of the plants I had seen in the jungle garden, so that they left the fingers readily, and they were heavy enough to fly far and true. They could be thrown point foremost like any knife, or made to spin in flight to cut down anything in their path with their deadly edges. I was eager, of course, to question Hildegrin about Votalus, but no opportunity to do so came until he had rowed us back across the silent lake. Then for a moment, Agia became so intent on driving Dorcas away that I was able to draw him to one side and whisper that I, too, was a friend of Votalus.
"You've mistaken me, young Sierra, for somebody else. Do you refer to Votalus the Outlaw?"
"I never forget a voice," I told him, "or anything else." And then in my eagerness, I impulsively added what was perhaps the worst thing I could have said. "You tried to brain me with your shovel." His face became mask-like at once, and he stepped back into his boat and rowed out onto the brown water. When Agia and I left the botanic gardens, Dorcas was still with us. Agia was anxious to make her go away, and for a time I permitted her to try. I was moved in part by the fear that with Dorcas near, it would be impossible for me to persuade Agia to lie with me, but even more by a vague appreciation of the pain Dorcas would feel, lost and dismayed as she was already, if she should see me die. Only a short time before, I had poured out to Agia all my sorrow at the death of Thecla. Now these new concerns had replaced it, and I found I had poured it out indeed, as a man might spill sour wine on the ground. By the use of the language of sorrow, I had, for the time being, obliterated my sorrow. So powerful is the charm of words, which for us reduces to manageable entities all the passions that would otherwise madden and destroy us. Whatever my motives may have been, and whatever Agia's may have been, and whatever Dorcas's may have been for following us, nothing Agia did succeeded. And in the end, I threatened to strike her, if she did not desist, and called to Dorcas, who was then 50 paces or so behind us. After that, we three trudged along in silence, drawing many strange looks. I was soaked to soddenness, and no longer cared whether my mantle covered my Fulgen torturer's cloak. Agia, in her torn brocade, must have looked nearly as strange as I. Dorcas was still smeared with mud. It dried on her in the warm spring wind that now wrapped the city, caking in her golden hair and leaving smears of powdery brown on her pale skin. Above us, the Avern brooded like a gonfalon. From it there drifted a myrrhic perfume. The half-closed flower still shone as white as bone, but its leaves looked nearly black in the sunlight.